This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is Jonathan Balcom, author of Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. He's also department chair for animal studies at Humane Society University. Jonathan Balcom, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Nice to be here, Matt.
Tell me a little bit about Humane Society University. I didn't know there was such.
Well, it's pretty new. We started offering degree programs in 2009. And it's the first university that really puts everything in the context of the human-animal relationship, and in particular, how to improve that relationship, how to have a world that's better for animals, and I would say by extension, better for humans as well.
And it's in Washington, D.C.?
That's our physical base, but we're an online university, so students can be anywhere in the world these days and take our courses.
And is there a website there?
There is, www.humanesocietyuniversity.org.
That's pretty easy, then. Tell me a little bit about your background. Do you have a bit of an English accent still? And so tell me, you know, where you grew up and how you got interested in this field.
I was born in England, and my parents were very adventurous. And in the early 60s, we moved to New Zealand at a time when New Zealand was welcoming desirable immigrants. So the passage was free. So my parents took them up on that, and we lived in Auckland for 5 years. Then I moved to Canada in 67. And grew up in Toronto from age 8 to 28, and then went to grad school at the University of Tennessee back in 1987. I've lived in the United States ever since. My interest in animals is lifelong. From my earliest memories, I was fascinated by animals.
You had a pet in the house, or?
Oh, we had cats, and at one point, guinea pigs, and you know, various creatures made their way into our home, partly because of me, I suppose, and. So, studying biology was sort of a natural fit for me, but I was also always deeply concerned about animals. I would go to great lengths not to step on a cricket, and some people I saw, you know, kids would deliberately step on them. So I was aware of a very different kind of way of interacting with animals. And ethology, which is the study of animal behavior, was a natural field for me to go into because it's involves. Traditionally, trying to study animals in their own environments, in their own milieu, and trying to understand them as they evolved, and that appealed to me very much.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Balcom. He's the author of Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. He's a biologist and ethologist, which is a new word to me. Always glad to learn a new word. Your early years as a biologist or being trained as a biologist, I read in this book, you had a kind of an early rebellion against the callousness toward animal lives, insect lives, was this case of a fruit fly. There were tell that story. It's kind of a funny story. There was some experiment going on with fruit fly eye color or something.
Right, yeah. It was a genetics lab. The fruit fly is sort of the ideal creature for geneticists, or at least is one they've been using a lot over the years. And in labs, these are kind of cookbook labs where it's not really science in the sense that you're not really testing hypotheses and learning new things. I mean, but we did collect data, and the data that day were to look at the genetic basis for eye color in flies, and we crossed different generations had been crossed earlier, and then we were to count the F1 generation, the next generation, in terms of eye color. And see how many had red eyes and how many had white eyes. And the basic procedure is these fruit flies are in these little clear plastic vials with a little sponge that's got what's called medium, which is a kind of a mixture of, I don't know, flour and whatever else that they feed on. And they pupate, they lay their eggs pupate, and then they hatch out. So you got these little vials with a little cloud of flies in them, and then you put, as I recall, like a little sponge or maybe cotton wool with ether into the lid, and that knocks them out, essentially etherizes them. They're still alive, but they're unconscious at the time. And that's an interesting word, isn't it, to apply to a fruit fly, unconscious. Studies show that actually fruit flies have an attention span, so I think the word consciousness might be worthily applied to that animal. Anyway, and then we had to count them, and you know, you did that by just, you know, you had them, had a little dissecting microscope, and you could see them count the eyes. Very easy to see the difference. And then the standard procedure was to tip the still anesthetized flies into the morgue, which is a little dish of oil where they would go to their permanent resting place. And I was not happy with that, so I thought, well, let's just... I just surreptitiously pushed my flies to the edge of the desk. It was a blacktop desk, so they weren't very easily seen, and I was a pretty compliant kid. I don't like breaking the rules, so I was a little uncomfortable with it, but I felt, I'm going to do this, and it was really cool to watch them gradually, come back to life. You could just see, some of them would spin around on one wing, and you see legs start to twitch and eventually stumble under their legs, and... As an ethologist or a budding ethologist, it was the animal behavior side of that lab was far more interesting to me than the genetics side of the lab, and to watch them stumble around and then take off was kind of liberating for me as well.
You haven't always then. I mean, at some point along the road, you didn't become such a compliant person. I mean, you've taken such a different path here, and that was a case where you just thought. I imagine that it was needlessly killing a fruit fly that just because you'd finished the experiment or the person running the experiment had finished them. But you moved on from there to defending animals and our changing our attitudes toward the animal kingdom, not just because they're living, but something even more. What's that?
Well, I think the key word here is sentience, and sentience is another word like ethology that a lot of people aren't familiar with, which is surprising to me that word hasn't made its way into consciousness because. It's the bedrock of ethics, in my opinion. Sentience is the capacity to feel. It's if you can feel pain, and you can probably also feel pleasure, but that makes you sentient. It probably requires that you have some level of consciousness, and there's endless scientific debates about where we draw the line on who's sentient and who isn't. I personally prefer to err on the side of caution, and if there's some decent reason to believe that an animal's sentient, then we maybe should grant it to them until we have better information that might indicate otherwise. And we tend to find that animals who we used to think aren't sentient actually are. Recent studies of crabs and shrimp, for instance, are finding that they avoid painful stimuli. They remember it. They will respond favorably to painkillers and this sort of thing. So the scientific evidence is pretty compelling that a lot of animals out there are sentient. We can argue how sentient. But back to your question, I mean... That's the key criterion by which we should gauge how we interact with animals. If an animal's sentient, if an animal can feel pain, and a lot of my work's been focused on animal pleasure, and that has important implications too. If an animal can feel pleasure, then life is worth living. Life has value, and that has to have some traction in how we humans treat other animals. And the big disconnect is that we currently our treatment of animals. And I'm talking about not Fluffy the dog at home, but I'm talking about animals caught up in the institutionalized use of animals, in particular the production of meat and dairy products, commercial fishing industry, fur industry, the recreational hunting and fishing, these kinds of domains. We treat animals as if they were so many blocks of wood instead of sentient beings, and that's the big disconnect. Most people hate cruelty to animals. I'd actually chatted with a fisherman this morning. I asked him about the fish he catches, and he didn't say he hates cruelty to animals, but he's a decent guy, cares about animals, And I asked him if he thought they felt pain. He said, yeah, I think they probably feel pain a little bit. But I asked him if he used hooks that had barbs or not, and he said, no, I use barbed hooks. And I said, how is that for the fish, do you think? He said, yeah, sometimes... It rips out a little bit when I pull it out, and I kind of winced. I thought, I wouldn't want to be in a fish in that situation. And so anyway, it's just that's just one little anecdote, example of how.
And is a barb hook much worse than just a hook with no barb?
Well, you try to put yourself in the animal's position, and if I had to have a piece of wire pulled out of my jaw, my mouth, my lips. Which are pretty sensitive in us, and I think they probably are in fishes. The idea of it having a barb on it, which is going to tear, is much more scary to me than if it doesn't have that barb.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Balcom. He's author of Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. He's the department chair for animal studies at Humane Society University. I'm interested, you're studying animal pleasure. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, you said?
Pleasure has been really neglected by science. I never really recall any discussions about animal pleasure during 10 years of biology education at three different universities. And if you open biology textbooks, you're not likely to find the word pleasure in the index. Why is that? It's such a curious thing. Pain is something that is not scientifically controversial. I know of at least 23 English language journals that have the word pain in the title of the journal. They're dedicated to the study of pain, and many of them do publish pretty nasty animal studies. So, you know, animals are part of that sort of area of scientific research. But there are no pleasure journals. There are no journals with the word pleasure in it. And it struck me, it was actually during a bird watching trip, watching an interaction between crows back in 2001, where I had this epiphany, you know, this light bulb went off in my head. It's like, well, what I just saw was clearly pleasurable. It was clearly motivated by the desire for pleasure. It was a social interaction, what we call allopreening, where one bird preens another, and the receiver was actually soliciting this by putting the neck in front of the first crow and essentially saying, you know, give me a back rub, would you? And it struck me then that we really haven't been talking about this. And pleasure is a very important part of our lives. We know that. The food we like to eat, the clothes we wear, the entertainment, the careers, the education we get. So much of what we do, the decisions we make in our daily lives, are informed by a desire for reward. And the reward system is wired in our brains and our biochemistry, and that's not a controversial thing scientifically. But the experience of pleasure, getting beyond the evolutionary basis for pleasure, the experience of it is not talked about by scientists. There hasn't been much. So I thought, well, that's a great subject. It's a buoyant subject. It's an upbeat subject. I work for animals, so a lot of it's grim, and, you know, you hear about the suffering of animals. But let's talk about the positive side of life for animals. So that set me on a journey that's, you know, 11 years later, and I'm still working on that and encouraging people to think more about animal pleasure.
And is there an evolutionary basis for it? Because you're a Darwinian, mm-hmm. I imagine.
Absolutely, I'm a Darwinian. I love evolution. And the way I like to put it is that the pain is nature's way of punishing maladaptive behavior, behavior that risks injury and death and compromising your ability to leave copies of your gene in the next generation, to put it really Darwinian and Darwinian way. Well, by comparison, pleasure is nature's way of encouraging good behavior, of promoting behavior that will, or encouraging, motivating behavior that will tend to cause the individual to have more chance of leaving more genes in the next generation. Feeding oneself, you know, being robust, being fit, being healthy, play behavior. We think of it as sort of almost a luxury or a bit frivolous, but play behavior has very good evolutionary basis. It builds strength. You learn the rules of social, good, proper social behavior, important skills about, you know, chasing or running away from a predator or chasing prey. So not surprisingly, chasing is very important. Rough and tumble play, which is teaching you how to subdue another or to get away from another. Again, very useful. And but play, animals don't study up on Darwinian fitness and evolutionary benefits. They play because, like we do, because it's fun. And it's clearly fun. They come back to it. You can look at their brains. You can look at their biochemistry. There's joy involved in that. So
I mean, I'm thinking of otters, you know, doing little somersaults in the water and things like that.
Yeah, there are books and books on animal play. There's lots of evidence for it. Even fish play is now beginning to be documented. And so it's widespread. It's adaptive. And it's pleasurable.
Jonathan Balcombe's my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Jonathan Balcombe's the author of Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals, and he's department chair for animal studies at Humane Society University. How do you answer the criticism that you're just anthropomorphizing? There was a big word that I learned growing up, that you're putting human emotions and feelings into animals that have none of that.
Yeah, anthropomorphism has been a bit of a dirty word in science for a long time. And as an anthropoid ape, I can't help seeing things through my own anthropoid lens. It helps, of course, to be aware of that and be guarded about that. And uncritical anthropomorphism is not a very useful thing. It's something we should be guarded about. I always like to give the example of looking at a bottlenose dolphin in a captive aquarium, a pool, which for them is an echolocating animal that typically lives in thousands of square miles of ocean. It's like living in a little house of mirrors. And because their echolocation calls just bounce back to them, and it's just essentially not a good situation for them. And yet they have this permanent smile on their face, and you could look and say, oh, look, the dolphin's happy because he's smiling. You know, I mean, that's anthropomorphism gone awry. That's very uncritical. We need to be critical in our anthropomorphism, and part of that is knowing the animal you're regarding, is knowing the behavior, knowing its biology, and then you're in a better position to interpret the behavior. So anthropomorphism is unavoidable, but it's also important. I mean, in a way, it's part of the interpretation we do, and we need to be very careful about it and know the animal.
You make claims for animals here that certainly weren't accepted a long time ago, and I think a lot of people would say, well, I don't really buy that, which is to say that animals feel, I think, pain. I think people can recognize that animals feel pain. Even fish feel pain, and other animals feel pain. But grief, affection, gratitude, sadness, empathy, you make all those claims. Explain that. What are they based on? Why do you think that's true?
Sure, and we can make the claim on the anthropomorphic grounds that, well, it looks like they're feeling grief. You know, the fluffy stopped eating for a couple of days or this sort of thing. And there's some validity to that, but it's not especially scientific. But we can study these things. We can study emotions. We can study them at the level of brain activity and neuroscience. And there are some scientists who are doing that now. Jaak Panksepp is notable for his studies of affective neuroscience. That is the neuroscience of feelings and emotions. And his book, Affective Neuroscience, came out in the late 90s and is really the source on that. We can also study it behaviorally. I'll give an example, a long-term study of baboons, Jane Goodall type study, where these animals have been known for decades and individuals and their relationships are known. And it showed by sampling fecal samples from individuals, you can look at hormone levels. And that's an important advance because the old way was to dart the animal and then take blood. And the animal gets stressed by that. So you have a big confound in what the hormone levels are going to be like. So by collecting poop from somebody, you can do it in a way that it's not stressing them. And in any event, they found that baboon mothers who've lost an infant to predation or whatever show the same patterns of glucocorticoid hormones that women do if they lose a child. So these are hormones that are associated with grief and loss and bereavement, and they go up significantly for about a month and then subside. Also, close relatives of the grieving mother in the baboon society also show an increase. So it appears they also are, through sort of an emotional osmosis or perhaps their own attachment to the infant who died, are also sharing in some of this grief. So and they also respond behaviorally by expanding their social networks, by grooming more with others. It sort of seems to be a form of therapy. So that's just one study that sort of indicates what we should expect in an evolutionary basis, and that is that emotions are very important. They're very useful. They probably evolved very early. Their substrate is the limbic system of the brain, a very old part of the brain that's shared by all vertebrates. And so there's very good scientific basis for animal emotion. It's not really, it shouldn't be controversial.
And what about altruism? I know there's I studied back in college, which was the late 1970s, I hazard to say, the selfish gene and this idea that all altruism had to be related to the furthering of the genes, either of your own or your kin. You have a different, more expansive take on that, I think.
Well, The Selfish Gene, very important book and a very important idea, and it came on the heels of this the idea called kin selection, which was first proposed by a British scientist in the early 60s. And it's widely accepted today as one of the explainers of certain types of social behavior in animals. You know, why ants will just readily sacrifice their lives. Well, they're much more closely related to their fellow workers in the colony than we are to our siblings, twice as closely related. So perhaps you would expect from a genetic basis that level of self-sacrifice, because what you're doing is if you're saving others, close relatives who share half your genes or more in some cases, I think, from a genetic standpoint, you are improving your genetic representation in future generations. But, you know, that's so mechanical, and it really denies the sort of the social conscious world we live in as well. And so, and it also doesn't explain a lot of the altruism that goes on, because you find lots of examples in our society and animal societies in which individuals help others who are not even relatives. So how do you explain that? A kin selection doesn't explain it. And Robert Trivers, an American biologist, in 1971 published a paper where he introduced the idea of reciprocal altruism. This is the idea that, quite aside from any genetic basis for behavior, doing a good deed to another is going to increase the likelihood they're going to return the deed to you. If you're talking about other individuals who are conscious, they have memories, they recognize individuals, and this is known from many studies of animals. And so living in a society tends to promote virtuous behavior by dint of the fact that you improve your lot by being good. And little wonder then that it feels good to do a good deed. You know, there's a reason why we have that expression, it's better to give than to receive. We get a little squirt of endorphins or whatever, you know, it feels good for us. And there's a good evolutionary basis for that. But once again, that pleasure is experienced in the here and now.
Speaking with Jonathan Balcom, he's the author of a really intriguing book called Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. And kind of following up on that, you have a different view of nature itself. It's not the cruel or just the cruel and barbaric place that it's often described as.
Yeah, I mean, probably anyone listening has heard the phrase nature red in tooth and claw. It's from a poem in the 19th century, a lovely poem, a sad poem, but it's sort of caught on. And if you turn on to nature documentaries, a lot of them are on TV, a lot of them are tailored to males in their mid-20s. Apparently that's the target audience, the primary demographic of nature documentaries. And maybe that's why the language is very much competitive and it's rough and harsh out there. I do think that there's a little bit of a motivation going on there, maybe subconsciously, that it makes us feel a little less guilty about our own sometimes rapacious relationship with animals. If we say that nature's harsh and cruel, well, we're justified in being harsh and cruel ourselves. I don't buy that for one minute, even if nature is harsh and cruel, because we can contemplate how we act and we can act better. We can choose. We can be good. We've ended the African slave trade. We've had a successful civil rights movement. Women got the vote. Colonialism is mostly over. Humans can do the right thing. We can be better. However, I do question the common impression that nature is harsh and cruel, that it's a constant struggle. If you look more closely, sure, there's a lot of competition in nature, but there's a lot of cooperation. Mutualisms, symbioses are widespread. I mean, you and I are walking symbiotic organisms. You look in the mirror, you know, 90% of what you're looking at is not you. It's actually someone else's genes. It's bacteria. 90% by numbers of cells. In terms of your biomass, most of it's you. I'm sure you'd be happy to know that. But we, you know, our guts contain a huge flora of a diverse array of symbiotic bacteria. They're not bad guys. You know, we have the antibacterial soap. It gives bacteria a bad name. Most bacteria in our bodies, at least, are very friendly, and they do a good job. They help us assimilate our food.
You talk about man's rapacious attitude toward nature. In your book, Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals, I'm just going to read a paragraph. The toll is just astronomical here. Over 50 billion land animals worldwide were killed for food in 2005. The number of individual fishes killed by humans may be higher still. Close to 100 million mice, rats, rabbits, monkeys, cats, dogs, and birds are consumed yearly in American labs. Between 40 and 70 million mourning doves are shot by American hunters yearly. That's hard to take as a bird watcher, as I am, and a dove is a beautiful, peaceful symbol of peace. Humane Society of the United States estimates that over 50 million animals are killed for their fur each year around the world. I take it you want all this to stop.
The sooner the better, as far as I'm concerned. You know, we don't have to be killing animals that way. Now, people can say, oh, what about the that community living on the beach there, and they've been eating fish for centuries, and that's their livelihood. You know, I'm not pointing a finger at them. I mean, we have to pick our targets, and maybe there'll come a day when we can actually have a universally more animal-friendly world. Well, I'm certainly aiming for that. But I'm talking about, yeah, the big commercial industries that that take animal life, and it's just something that... There's sort of two levels of addressing it. One is at the macro level, and that's really vitally important. We need new laws. We need to pass laws that at least curb some of the more harmful and damaging practices that are going on. I mean, factory farming is an absolutely abomination. And it's just, I remember, just as an example, I remember being in a grocery store and a guy had just grabbed a big hunk of meat out of the meat thing in the supermarket. And he happened to have a shirt on, you know, Montgomery County Humane Society, whichever one it was. And there's the disconnect right there, you know. People love animals. They don't like them to suffer. And yet we fund it. We fund some of the worst abuses of animals when we go to the supermarket so often. People need to be informed about that. They can make better choices. It's getting easier and easier to choose vegetarian products, vegan products that are animal-friendly. Well, obviously animal-friendly. They don't contain animals, but they taste a lot like that meat. So I do encourage people. I do link this to personal lifestyle choices.
Did you talk to that guy?
I didn't. It was many years ago, but that's a good question, you know. I mean, it's not easy to get, I mean, people have egos, and you have to play it carefully with that kind of individual activism. But definitely, we have to have dialogue. We have to have people being aware of these things, and that's partly why I lecture and write books, is to get the information out there. Do I think everyone is going to be a vegetarian next week? No, that's not going to happen. But people can make a difference by eating less, for starters. If you eat less, go become vegetarian. If you're a vegetarian already, become vegan. Those are huge personal steps. I regard them as veganism as the sort of the holy grail of personal activism for animals, and by extension, one's personal health and the environment.
And how long have you been a vegan?
You know, what is a vegan? A vegan is someone who tries to minimize their negative impact on animals. So it's not perfection, but I've not bought cow's milk and eggs for 2 decades now. Wow. So I've been sort of on that path. But, you know, we all make our effort as best we can.
My guest is Jonathan Balcombe. He's author of Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. He's also department chair for animal studies at Humane Society University. You mentioned that laws can change and we can put laws on the books. In reading your Second Nature, I learned that there are some states that have outlawed, and I guess all of Europe or much of Europe, veal calf pens, little cages. I didn't realize that was going on. I knew the practice was going on and how cruel it was, but I didn't know that there were laws on the books in some states, even in the U.S., that had banned that.
Correct. Yeah, the EU, the European Union, is phasing out factory farming practices. This year, 2012, is a very significant year for the end of battery caging of chickens European Union-wide. And the chicken industry there, not surprisingly, you know, put up a fight and tried to get an extended and that sort of thing. So Europe has been sort of the world leader. They've got a long way to go, but they're ahead of us. But the U.S. is definitely starting to show some interesting signs. There's been several state laws passed phasing out and banning things like breeding crates for gestation crates for sows, and the battery cage for hens. So state by state, and meat consumption has declined several years in a row now in the United States. So the public consciousness appears to be beginning to embrace the idea that factory farming and commercial meat production in its current guise is not acceptable.
Is that partly because people think it's bad for their health, or they just or are they buying your argument that these are sentient beings and we shouldn't be killing these sentient beings?
It's a great question. I certainly don't know the answer. I don't know if anyone knows the answer. It's probably a combination of factors. Public awareness of the health implications, I would say, probably is reason number one, I would guess. The ethical basis for it probably is a reason that might be playing into it, but I would think it's mostly personal health. That seems to be more widely accepted now. And maybe the environmental awareness, too, because it's a big environmental issue.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Is there one website you want to send people to, or one last thought you want to leave people with?
I would just say be conscious of your own lifestyle and how it affects other beings whose lives matter, and that's a good thing to do. It's important.
Jonathan Balcombe, thanks so much for being my guest today. He's the author of Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. This is Progressive Radio.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.